missionary in the undertaking to link colleges in the area a little bit more closely with the Miller Center. That's one of our hopes and dreams, that the university being one of the few that has a center for the study of the presidency and governance now, we might cooperate with and mutually assist one another in the development of programs. So Larry Evans is that kind of a pioneer as well. Professor Evans was born in Boston, and therefore at this time of year, the year, is suffering greatly. As usual, the Red Sox teeter on the edge of success or failure. But this makes for strength of character for anybody from Boston. He did his undergraduate work at Kenyon College, studied in the graduate department of economics at UVA for a time, but then let go of the dismal science to move to the queen of the sciences, political science, at the University of Rochester, where he worked with Richard Fenno. He's been at William and Mary as professor of government now for 4 years. His primary research interest is legislative leadership, and he recently completed a book on leadership styles of 8 committee leaders in the United States Senate. Last August 30th, 31st, whatever the date was, presented a paper at the American Political Science Association on committee foresight and committee power, another study of the congressional political process. And now he's embarking on a book-length study of Senate party leadership. So on a day when the Senate is setting forth on confirmation hearings of Judge Souter, Freudian slip. Well, we feel very privileged to have someone discussing the role of Senate leadership with us.
Yes, sir. Thanks a lot. I don't feel like a missionary, but feel like mostly a congressional scholar, and I should warn you about congressional scholars. Invariably, we enjoy the institution, and when we start talking about it, we never shut up. And I've been told this by all my friends, that when I start talking about the Congress, they sort of bat in the hatch and get ready for an hour and a half dissertation. I won't do that. I promise I won't do that. I've got my watch right here. It's going to stay within my view. As Ken said, I'm in sort of embarked on a long-range project trying to get a feel for legislative leadership. My interest is larger than that. I'm primarily interested in the nature of leadership in American politics, and leadership, of course, is tied directly to questions of governance. I don't think you can separate the two. But my focus is on legislative leadership, particularly in the Senate. The reason I chose the Senate is that relative to our other institutions, I think none of them better embody the fragmentation, the dispersion of power, the atomization, if you will, that's built into our constitutional framework. So it's possible to study the Senate and through that get a feel for what some of the issues are which drive American politics. In other words, I use it as a window more than anything else. And I tend to use committees in the Senate as a window to address larger issues concern the institution as a whole. Most of you know this, I'm sure. The vast majority of the things that get done in the Senate, the extent that anything gets done in the Senate, occurs in committee. Most of the work gets done there. The floor, very active, turn on C-SPAN and see any number of senators popping off on any number of subjects at basically any hour. But most of the real work gets done in committee. So to explore some fundamental issues about leadership and policymaking and governance, what I selected to do was to focus on four committees of the United States Senate during the 1980s and take a look at the eight leaders who were responsible for leading those committees. I don't have time today to talk about all eight of these individuals. They range from people like Edward Kennedy to Strom Thurmond, so there's a bit of a range there. I'm going to focus on just two and try to go as far as I can with the themes of the book in particular with regard to these two senators. The two are Robert Stafford, who was a former senator. He retired in 1988 from Vermont. Entered politics right after the war and was in the Senate, I think, from about 1971 or so to 1988. Very much a Vermont Yankee, moderate Republican, one of the best liked and most respected members of the chamber, although perhaps not the best known. The other senator I'm looking at is Orrin Hatch, who I think is a little bit better known because he's been at a number of national forums, a number of hearings, and he'll be part of the Souter hearings, as he was part of the Bork hearings as well. Stafford, from 81 to 87, was chairman of the Senate Committee on Environment and Public Works. That committee has jurisdiction over environmental issues, pork barrel things like water projects, highway development. One of the more controversial jurisdictions, I think, during the 1980s, you recall that 1980, Ronald Reagan impressed a lot of people at a campaign stop when he announced that one of the primary causes of air pollution was trees, which caught my attention and caught the attention of a lot of people, including some students at a campus that he was to speak at soon after, who confronted him with cards or placards they placed on a bunch of trees that said, "Stop me before I kill again." This set the stage for what was to follow in the environmental area, which was a lot of controversy. James Watt and Gorsuch on down the line, certainly a heated policy area during the 1980s. Orrin Hatch also was no foreigner to controversy during the 1980s. He was chair of the Committee on Labor and Human Resources, which has jurisdiction over labor relation issues, health, the handicapped, basically the sorts of programs that constituted Lyndon Johnson's Great Society. Hatch is a conservative. He would have liked to turn back a lot of those programs, particularly in the area of labor. Indeed, he first became nationally known in the late 1970s when, as a freshman senator, he was single-handedly responsible for killing off or filibustering to death a major labor reform bill that got him the nickname Boren Orrin, which has stuck with him. It's not entirely fair. And also a threat from George Meany that do what they can, the AFL-CIO would get rid of him by 1980. 1981, he became chairman of the committee with jurisdiction over Meany's issues. And that led to a fairly partisan 6 years. So I'm looking at these two chairmen, two fairly important jurisdictions during the Republican years of control of the United States Senate. And I can talk a little bit later about whether or not some of the generalizations hold up. My focus then is my aim is to use their experiences as a window, as a vehicle for addressing some larger questions about leadership and governance. To provide some greater focus about leadership, because it's a fairly ambiguous, large term which runs across a lot of concepts, I want to focus on their behavior, what they did, what their tactics and strategies were, and then the consequences of those tactics and strategies for power, for what happened, for policy. The behavior, the aspects of behavior that I focus on are these two chairs' manipulation of their agendas. Chairman and the Senate control their own agendas. They do the scheduling, and that's crucial. A lot of people try to separate procedural prerogatives from policy, but you can't do that. There is no way to separate procedure from politics, and as I think we'll see, this is very important to both committees. Next, I want to look at the way each one of these chairs dealt with their own ranks and file, with other senators who are on the committee, to get a feel for those relationships. I also want to look at the way they deal with other leaders. Each committee has a chair and a ranking minority member. Ranking minority members in the mid-80s were Democrats who led those committees for their fellow partisans. I'm going to take a look at those relationships. And then fourth, I want to take a look at the impact that the chamber as a whole and other stages in the policymaking process had on these leaders. The best way to think about American politics and policymaking is as basically an interconnected set, a sequence of decision-making arenas, and what happens further on and expectations about what will happen further on in that sequence affect behavior early on. For example, chairs a lot of the time will take into account the mood of the floor and what they perceive the mood of the floor to be and adjust their behavior in committee to take that into account. So I want to talk a bit about that. My goal here, though, and my goal in my research isn't just to describe what these individuals do, although that's a large part of it, and it's a lot of work. It's also to develop an explanatory framework so that I can understand why they did what they did, something that perhaps can be applied to other committees, maybe to the House, and maybe to other leaders in other contexts. I focus on five explanatory variables or explanatory factors. The most important ones are contextual. That's one of the most striking things I feel about the study of leadership in American politics. What political scientists have found is that you can explain most of what leaders do from contextual factors alone. In other words, personality is certainly important, but the context within which they operate basically drives behavior. This should come as no great surprise, because politicians as a class of human being are among the most responsive you will ever find to the incentives they face, particularly electoral incentives. We can go a long way to predicting what they'll do from those electoral incentives alone. Don't have to look at life experience and family background quite as much as might be expected. So I look at two sets of contextual factors. One, the distribution of preferences and intensity of preferences within their own committees among the rank and file. And then second, this is what I call the structural context, which is essentially the structure of the committees they lead, whether or not they're decentralized or centralized. On some committees, subcommittees, subunits of the full committee regularly hold markup sessions or meetings. The effect of this is to disperse power a little bit because other members, subcommittee chairs, for example, have some control over the agenda and may control to a certain extent what comes up and what doesn't, not the chair. In addition, in the Senate, in the House as well, it's useful to think about legislation basically as congealed information. And information is scarce because they have so much work to do, or maybe because they have created so much work for them to do, one or the other. But in the Senate, the chief resource for gathering information is staff. Therefore, those who control staff have greater access to information. The extent that information is power, you would expect them also to have disproportionate influence. So I think a little bit about the structure of these committees as well and the consequences for power. It isn't possible to totally escape individual characteristics, of course. All you have to do is take a look at Strom Thurmond on the one hand and Edward Kennedy, for example, on the other, and to realize they're just different. It's got nothing to do with the context within which they lead. They are just different. Human beings, different politicians. We need to at least think about that. The problem is that if we engage in too much psychologizing, we're apt to lose track of reality, basically. It's difficult to put these individuals on the couch. I've never tried to do that in my interviews with them, and I never will, because I don't think it would be too good for rapport. But there are certain individual characteristics we can look at that are fairly objective and also important. And I just want to mention three. Today, the first would simply be their policy preferences. The fact that Thurmond is a conservative, Kennedy is a liberal, matters. We also want to think about their intensity of their preferences across different issues. Kennedy cares a lot about health. He doesn't care quite as much about antitrust. Thurmond cares a lot about crime control. Doesn't care quite as much about a lot of the issues that Kennedy cares about. Obviously, the intensity of preferences will have something to do with how involved legislator will be in a particular area, how much they care. This has an influence on their choice of tactics. And two other variables, individual variables I want to mention, characteristics. First, a senator's or a chair's experience, the quantity of time they've been in the chamber matters. Obviously, again, with Strom Thurmond, who's been in there basically forever, sometimes it appears he's been in the Senate since the early 50s, and that was after running for president and being governor, and he's still running strong. He'll bury me, I'm sure. This fellow has tremendous experience, a tremendous breadth of experience. We have to think about his current behavior in terms of that larger career. And then finally, a legislator's or a chair's or a leader's proximate career plans, where they plan to be 1, 2, 3 years down the line, affects their behavior today. For example, if a senator's about to retire, this was a situation that Robert Stafford was in, I'll talk about it in a minute, that essentially severs the electoral connection, and he's free to pursue his own policy goals, not having to worry too much about currying favor with the folks back home, and that matters for leadership. So I have essentially four aspects of leadership behavior I want to look at. I've got five what I call explanatory factors, which provide some guidance about what happens with those four avenues of behavior. That's the sort of underlying analytical framework of my book about leadership and committee, and I plan to use something like that in another book about party leadership that I will get to sometime. I'm expected to get to it this year, but it keeps being pushed off. I'm expecting another child in January, and other things are intervening. I'm painting a lot of walls and whatnot. But I do want to talk a little bit about how this framework can be used to discuss both Stafford and Hatch, because I think they're fairly interesting individuals, and we can say a lot about what they do using these variables. First, let me begin with Stafford. Stafford was chair of the Environment and Public Works Committee, as I mentioned. A fair amount of controversy in that issue area, but not in committee. The Environment and Public Works Committee in the Senate, it's still this way, and it's been this way for 15, 20 years, is fairly consensual, tilted toward the environmentalist position. So in committee, you've got quite a bit of consensus. A few pockets of dissension, mostly led by Alan Simpson of Wyoming, who's a conservative Westerner and is not quite as friendly towards the environmentalist position as Stafford and the majority. But still, a fair amount of consensus in that panel. On the floor of the Senate, however, and the Senate as a whole, it's very different. There's a lot of conflict there. So what Stafford had to deal with as chair was essentially a distribution of preferences, which was favorable to him in committee, but not quite so favorable on the floor. And that structured a lot of his behavior as chair. For example, Max Baucus, who's a Democrat, said the following. I should say, I spoke with a number of senators as part of this project, and that these will be the data I'll present here. I have other data as more statistical stuff, but I think this carries the argument rather well. Baucus, Montana, Democrat. Environment and Public Works isn't a partisan committee. There's a lack of partisanship due to the membership. We don't have the tree huggers versus the tree rapists. Conservation is an important issue in a lot of states, including Montana. Steve Sims, one of the conservative Westerners on the panel, basically says the same thing. And then argues that the name of the panel ought to be changed to Public Works and Environment, because that's what he cares about. Orrin Hatch, in contrast, chair of the Labor Committee again, which was then one of the most polarized committees in Congress, a little bit less so now with Edward Kennedy's chair, but then it was a really interesting split. You had seven conservative Republicans, a wall of conservative Republicans who agreed on basically everything, facing off against seven liberal Democrats led by Edward Kennedy, some of the most senior members of the chamber, Claiborne Pell, Howard Metzenbaum, down the line. So it was 7-7, and in the middle were two Republicans who were sort of moderate to liberal in ideology. One was Lowell Weicker of Connecticut, who's no longer in the chamber, who was a fairly liberal Republican, probably the most liberal Republican in the institution, and also Robert Stafford, who happened to be on this committee as well. You see a lot of that in the Senate. Stafford was a moderate on many of these issues. So it was seven over here, seven over there, two in the middle. The problem for Hatch, though, is that those two in the middle on these issues were closer to Kennedy than they were to him. As a result, although he had a partisan majority of 9-7, he had an ideological minority of 7-9. He didn't have the votes in his own committee to win. I asked Hatch about that, and he was very straightforward about it. It was difficult. We had a majority of 9-7 Republicans, but when you added two liberal Republicans, Lowell Weicker and Bob Stafford, to the Democrats, it was 9-7 in favor of them. So we had some votes that were 9-7 and some that were 8-8, and a lot that were 7-9 that he lost, unfortunately, for Hatch and his agenda. When we look at the structures of these two committees, they also vary. The structure, again, staff and agenda, the role of subcommittees, things of this sort, was fairly centralized on the Environment Public Works Committee. Stafford basically hired and fired the staff. They worked for him and they pursued his agenda, providing him with important information. In addition, the subcommittee chairs, although they could hold markup sessions, formal meetings, didn't do it all that often. So the control of the agenda basically was in Stafford's hands. So right off the bat, from structural arrangements alone, Stafford had tremendous resources that often translated into power. Orrin Hatch, as he was at a disadvantage in the preference context, also was at a disadvantage here. Labor and human resources has long been one of the most decentralized panels in Congress. Subcommittees regularly hold markups, and they basically hire most of the staff. So Hatch had fewer people working for him, and his control over agenda prerogatives was circumscribed somewhat by the role of the subcommittees. Let me just briefly talk about these individual variables that I mentioned. On personal preferences, Stafford, a moderate to pro-environmental senator, he had a League of Conservation Voters score of 70, which is pretty good, it's in the middle that year, faced off a ranking minority member, the leader of the Democrats on his committee, Lloyd Benson, who was basically in the same category. He had a 60 on that same measure. So they basically agreed on most things. As a result, compromise at the leadership level, cooperation at the leadership level was common on Environment and Public Works, giving Stafford another leg up. Orrin Hatch, well, he faced off against Edward Kennedy. Americans for Democratic Action liberalism score of 10 for Orrin Hatch, which is not high, and 85 for Edward Kennedy. They just disagree on about anything and everything, and that was important for understanding relations at the leadership level on that panel. As far as their experience goes, with these particular senators, that variable doesn't do much for me. Leadership experience tells me a lot about Orrin Hatch, a lot about Strom Thurmond. It tells me a lot about some of the leaders who were less experienced, but both of these were, Hatch and Stafford, fairly experienced as leaders, and by the time I studied their committees, they'd both been chair for about 4 years. So basically, I'm just going to pass this variable by, but I should say that it has proven useful in analyzing other senators. As far as their career plans, as I said, Stafford planned to retire, severing the electoral connection. Orrin Hatch, interestingly enough, didn't plan to retire, but he did plan to leave the chairmanship of the Labor Committee to chair Judiciary because of a series of personnel changes. That job was opening up, and he was second in line, basically, and he would have been able to move in that position and escape this rather unfortunate set of circumstances on labor where he didn't have the votes. And as a result, his commitment to the panel, labor panel, tended to go down. Okay, that's just by way of background material. Now let me talk a bit about what they did as leader, and then I'll try to generalize a bit about the consequences for our understanding of leadership more generally. First, the agenda. Stafford, you'll recall, dealt with a situation where he had consensus in committee, conflict on the floor. As a result, there were incentives for him in committee put legislation on a fast track. Instead of using the agenda to slow things down and sort of put them off, which is the classic strategy, he accelerated them and brought things to the top. He tried to speed things up. It was very obvious what he was up to, and he spoke to it, and others spoke to it as well. This was a conscious strategy. The idea was get legislation out of committee where there's not a real problem anyway, get it to the floor so there's as much time as possible to deal with this stuff before the end of a Congress. So the distribution of preferences in committee essentially led him to pursue what could be called an accelerationist strategy on the agenda. For example, with Superfund, an incredibly complex piece of legislation, perhaps the most complex piece of legislation that Congress deals with. Reauthorization of Superfund was brought forward in 1985. It also had to be referred to a number of other committees. It was a big job. Stafford, though, managed to introduce this legislation on January 3rd, when most of these fellows are still struggling back on the plane trying to find their offices. They held markups in February. By this time, most of them have found their offices, but the last thing they want to do is hold meetings. They reported the legislation to the floor on March 1st, which is incredibly early. Then he shepherded that legislation through the Senate. It was finally passed by the institution on September 26th. which is an incredible achievement. That is just a magnificent legislative achievement. And again, it was driven primarily by his strategy of using the agenda to push things forward, put things on a fast track. Hatch, in contrast, on the Labor Committee, did the opposite. And I think the reasons for that are fairly straightforward. He didn't have the votes to win. If he'd sat back and let issues bubble up naturally, Kennedy would have clobbered him. He would have had the votes, and Hatch would have lost. As a result, what Hatch did was use his control over the agenda to refuse to schedule things for markup. Basically, he said, we're not going to do those issues this year. And they were very straightforward about it. I asked Hatch about this, and he immediately responded with what I believed before was the right answer. I was glad that he felt the same way. He said there was constant pressure from the Democrats on the agenda. They were very good at it, to give them credit. But I controlled the agenda. As long as the Democrats wanted something, they had to be accommodated. Howard Metzenbaum, a liberal from Ohio, agrees with Hatch on this, if nothing else, and said that the chairman of the committee didn't have the votes to control his own committee. Senator Kennedy had the votes to win, and that's what counts, whether or not you have the votes. Senator Hatch's style was to use the schedule, not putting items on the calendar, not pushing things. I asked Kennedy the same question, and he agreed. Again, the chairman has enormous power, setting the agenda, the prerogatives of leadership. We had a difficult time under Hatch advancing our issues. Paul Simon, another liberal Democrat on the committee from Illinois. There wasn't much activity when Orrin was chairman. Orrin isn't an activist, and there was not a lot of meetings. Also, he was facing Weicker and Stafford, who more often voted with the Democrats. Again, this was primarily driven by the distribution of preferences, the fact he lacked the votes. We should also note, though, that the cost to Hatch from this strategy were fairly low, because he was going to leave the committee. He thought leave leadership on that committee at the end of that Congress, and thus closing it down really didn't hurt him all that much, because he was moving his issue agenda over to another panel. That's the agenda. I'd like to talk a little bit about their interactions with other members of their committees, in particular the subcommittee chairs. Again, committees are comprised of subcommittees, subunits of the parent committee, which sort of take a first cut at legislation. Thus, the interactions that the tactics that the chairs use with their subcommittee chairs are quite important. Subcommittee chairs and Senate are powerful. They have control over staff a lot of the time, but most important, they're just interested in those jurisdictions. And since they're interested, they tend to focus. And in the Senate, focusing is often enough to become powerful. The chairs usually respond to subcommittee activism with a mixture of delegation and monitoring strategies. In other words, they're willing to delegate responsibilities to these subcommittee chairs to economize on their own workload, but they also tend to monitor what they do to protect their interests. Robert Stafford on Environment and Public Works, when we look at the way he dealt with his subcommittee chairs, Stafford was much more influential relative to these subcommittee chairs than was the case with Hatch on labor. Again, the primary reason is because Stafford had the resources, particularly staff, the agenda, and the votes. But he also delegated. I asked Stafford about that. He responded, we had good people, Chafee Gordon Evans. On the Democratic side, it was Mitchell Baucus Lautenberg, and these were all subcommittee leaders. They were the leaders and the thought framers on environmental legislation. In large part, Stafford's strategy of delegation was due to the technical nature of environmental issues, these information costs I referred to before. George Mitchell, who's now majority leader of the Senate, a longtime member of Environment and Public Works, very perceptive observer. He's one of these people, when you interview them, you realize very quickly that he is doing you a great favor by talking to you, because he's thought about these issues a lot more than most academics. Mitchell told me that, this is a quote, there's not enough time to digest the information to be knowledgeable to write every bill on Environment and Public Works. It's difficult to gain expertise. The same relationship exists between committee and the floor and the subcommittee and the committee. The subcommittee members have larger impact. They're the ones managing the legislation, leading the debate. They have more background. And these subcommittee leaders and the full committee leaders on Environment and Public Works primarily depend on the staff for information. Indeed, that staff is probably the most powerful in Congress on Environment and Public Works. Orrin Hatch, as I said, was less influential than Stafford relative to his rank and file and his subcommittee chairs, again, primarily because of the centralization of the process and the preference context. But this tended to vary quite a bit, and this is a point I think needs to be thought about a bit more, and I'll mention it at the end. We tend to think about leadership styles as monolithic things, but for those of you who follow the Congress at all, it's very clear very quickly that legislative leadership styles vary significantly from issue to issue for individual leaders as well as across different leaders. And we need to think about that to get a feel for what leadership means and governance means in Congress. Hatch was most influential on health issues where there was no subcommittee. He just decided to hold that at full committee and not create a subcommittee. Indeed, Kennedy, now the chair, has done the same thing. On subcommittees chaired by other conservative Republicans, Hatch tended to give them a free hand, let them do what they want. However, on those chaired by the two moderate to liberal Republicans, Weicker and Stafford, his strategies were very different. He monitored them quite closely. According to Hatch, I deferred to the subcommittees, but I stepped in when there were log jams. On education, I gave Stafford a lot of leeway, but we watched them carefully. There were limits, and they knew it. I threatened to shut things down at times, used some of the finesse available to the chairman. So clearly they differ in the way they interact with their subcommittee chairs. Now let's think about the way they interacted with other leaders, in particular the way Stafford interacted with Lloyd Benson, his partner in leadership on environment and public works, and the way Hatch interacted with Kennedy. This will give you a feel for partisanship on these two panels and how it varied. It's two staffers commenting, one for the Environment and Public Works Committee. There's no majority-minority split on this committee. When we're negotiating with the Energy Committee, it's much more obvious. We just don't operate that way. It's more like being a member of a family, okay? One thing that that Kennedy and Hatch were never accused of was being a member of the same family. One staffer described partisanship on that panel in basically this way. Basically, you've got a bunch of very conservative Republicans like Hatch and Nichols facing off against the likes of Kennedy and Howard Metzenbaum. Hatch doesn't have the votes to do anything, and Kennedy just sits there and blows cigar smoke in his face. That's an accurate description of some of those meetings. The Stafford-Benson relationship was very cooperative. It was really best described as a collaboration. Benson, getting ready to move on to chair the Finance Committee, wasn't as interested in Environment and Public Works as he might have been. Again, his career plans and individual characteristic had an effect. Basically, he tended to focus on what was good for his constituents in Texas. And as long as Stafford stayed clear of the Texas delegation, he was fine. They got along great. Hatch and Kennedy, much more partisan. I asked Kennedy about partisanship on that panel, and he said this: there's been an important shift in the public mood. The country has really made the decisions. The question is the instrument. On issues of basic fairness, the Republicans are now caught in the crosswind. That's what happens when you hire speechwriters from Harvard, I think. Orrin Hatch responded in similar terms to the same question, but the flip side, really. We accomplished a lot, but it was difficult. The Democrats had their agenda, and we had ours. We didn't do very much in the labor area. That's hard because neither side wants to give very much. What's interesting, though, is when you do a statistical analysis of participation and influence on the bills considered by these committees, that it's clear that Hatch and Kennedy were active across the board, and the bills that came forward were bills that had their stamps on them, just like Stafford and Benson were active on in a collaborative sense on a lot of environment and public works legislation. Indeed, if you just look at the statistical results, the Hatch-Kennedy relationship looks a lot like the Stafford-Benson relationship, which suggests some of the limitations of statistical analysis. But it's interesting, and I think it does suggest something about the nature of politics and cooperation on that committee. The reason that Hatch and Kennedy worked together, as did Stafford and Benson, is because they had no choice. For legislation to go forward, Hatch needed Kennedy, otherwise he didn't have the votes. But Kennedy also needed Hatch, because Hatch controlled the agenda. Thus, in the absence of a Kennedy-Hatch coalition, basically a coalition of the whole, nothing happened. And as a result, you ended up with a collaboration of sorts, an uneasy collaboration, but still a collaboration. As Hatch put it, we had a very difficult set of parameters. I certainly couldn't dictate to the committee. I wouldn't have any way. We had to accommodate, and this is the key point. It was a classic compromise committee. which is nothing short of amazing given the partisan tensions on that panel. The fourth aspect of behavior I was going to talk about is anticipated reactions, this notion that chairs think about further stages in the sequence, particularly the Senate floor, and that affects what they do in committee. Indeed, there are differences, big differences, across the two panels, but time is moving on, and I want to move on to something else. I'd be glad to take that as a question. I want to talk a little bit about how these tactics they employ on the agenda, the way they interact with the committee members, and the way they interact with other leaders, link up with power and also governance to a certain extent. Just as the tactics they employ in committee vary in systematic ways, the links between tactics and power vary in systematic ways, and what we should think about in terms of governance on these panels varies in systematic ways. What I'm saying is that governance is not a monolithic thing. It varies. It's different. We have to think about that to understand it. Stafford on the Environment and Public Works Committee exerted power. There's no doubt about that. Legislation looked more like his preferences than it would have been if he hadn't been in the chair. The sources of his power, it should be clear from previous discussion, basically three: administrative, procedural, and informational. He managed the committee. He moved things forward. He made sure that the trains ran on time. That was probably the least important aspect of his leadership. A bit more important were his procedural tactics, accelerating deliberations, moving things to the top of the agenda. That obviously helped, and certainly helped get things through, and was responsible for the fact that so many environmental programs were successfully reauthorized during the 1980s. But the most important aspect of his leadership was informational. Because of the technical nature of these issues, it was difficult, and is difficult, for legislators to understand the links between concrete policy alternatives on the one hand and outcomes on the other. In other words, the average senator knows basically whether he or she favors legislation that's going to hurt business or perhaps help the environment or whatever that trade-off is. There's an underlying dimension where you can array policy outcomes, pro-environment, pro-industry. They basically know where they stand. They can also read pieces of legislation. They don't very often. Their staffers do. But it's also possible to get a feel for what's in legislation. What's difficult and where the uncertainty arises is on the links between what the legislation says and what it'll do, and interpreting the meaning, the policy consequences of this legislation. And that was the opening for leadership for Robert Stafford on that committee, and that's where he had his biggest impact. Alan Simpson, a tremendous senator, a very, very entertaining guy if you've ever seen him speak. I spoke to him at length about a number of things, and I lost two-thirds of it because he's so funny that you just start laughing and it just slides right by you. He's the sort of person who has to be taped to fully get all of his comments. But I did get enough down to get a feel for Simpson's views about the role of staff and information on this committee. And this is some of the things that Simpson said to me. On Environment and Public Works, there's all this talk about showers of purple mist in New Jersey that will leave you sterilized. So you either fall over passionately or you're evil, okay? There's more of a kidding atmosphere on judiciary, more of an openness. The staffers are less ideological. The entire staff has the same mindset on Environment and Public Works. He continued along that way. About 20 members in the United States Senate understand Superfund legislation. It takes away the yeast of legislating when all is leavened the same way. The staff is using us as its troubadours. There should be more balance, a balance of thought. There's all this talk about how uranium mill tailings will leave you sterilized. I always thought they'd just give you cancer, but you know, what do I know? That's not true. Antelope eat the grass that grows over them. I sent the staff to see a surface mine in Wyoming. It wasn't anything you want to take a picture of, but it was filled in and covered with grass. The only difference is the grass is a little greener. But they thought surface coal, Pittsburgh 30 years ago. What Simpson is arguing here, and what he argued more generally, and has argued for many years, is that the staff is monolithic. They control the information. They work for Stafford. Therefore, people like him have a disadvantage. They can't really participate and effectively offer alternatives. So information in this issue area translates directly into power. And since the leader controls the information, the leader exerts disproportionate influence. One caveat there, though. Stafford, as I said, is one of the most trusted members of the United States Senate. If he was systematically misleading his colleagues about information, he wouldn't be trusted, and indeed he wouldn't be effective. So one question to ask is, if Stafford is so trusted as a source of information, how is it that his information translates into power? There's sort of a tension there. Well, the tension is there unless we distinguish between the stages of the policy process that one sometimes calls formulation and modification. By formulation, I'm talking about the construction of concrete alternatives, actually putting the language together that people vote on. Information is definitely important there, and Stafford had a disproportionate access to important information. Simpson was left out and still is. The modification stage, though, occurs when legislators decide how to choose between different alternatives that are already there. Typically, what they'll do is they'll go to experts like Stafford and say, what does this mean? What does that mean? What does this mean? Is this going to hurt me? At that stage of the process, Stafford and his colleagues are very straightforward. They fully provide the information. There's no misleading other colleagues there. Otherwise, their effectiveness would go way down. Thus, it's important to emphasize that information becomes power, but it becomes power at the beginning of the process, when you construct alternatives, when you formulate legislation, not at the modification stage of the process. And I think this has certain implications for how we should study the way leaders use their informational advantage. I'll talk more about that later. Hatch on labor also had a tremendous impact on policy within his panel, but it was almost entirely driven by procedure, in particular his use of the agenda. You might want to think about this in sort of spatially, if you can somehow array the preferences of Stafford and Weicker and Hatch and existing law, sort of the current status quo along a line. A lot of the times you had a situation where Hatch was out on the right, Stafford and Weicker and Kennedy were out on the left, and existing law was somewhere in the middle. So Hatch favored more conservative bills, Weicker, Stafford, Kennedy more liberal bills, and the existing law was in the middle. When the situation was like that, there was nothing Hatch could do that would gain him anything with regard to putting policy forward, because if legislation moved forward, Weicker and Stafford would win, and that would move the outcome, the policy, away from what he wanted. It was a no-win situation. His result was to close the gates and say, we're not gonna hold a meeting on that, and that was it. Tremendous impact over the committee because of that. Another configuration which often arose was when Hatch and the two swing voters, Weicker and Stafford, both wanted changes to existing law, but Weicker and Stafford wanted more liberal alternatives, say legislation for the handicapped, where Hatch wanted a greater federal role, but not so much as Weicker and Stafford. Here, Hatch was in the middle, with existing law here, and Weicker and Stafford here. And what Hatch would do was say, look, unless you give me what I want, I am going to close the gates. He threatened to do it. Weicker and Stafford would then cut a deal with him that basically resulted in Hatch winning and getting what he wanted. Then the bill would be brought up, be a consensus package, and it would slide through the Senate. That happened on a number of occasions. So let me just close then with a few points that I think we can draw from this discussion, which are important for the understanding of both leadership and governance in Congress. First, I think the framework I've developed is useful. I think it can be applied to the majority leadership and minority leadership on the floor. I think it can be applied to leadership in the House as well. And some of these ideas, I think, can be applied to the presidency. I think that that I hope this will be used when the book comes out in the spring. Second, we've got to distinguish We've got to think about how leadership varies by issue. I think this is particularly important for understanding of presidential leadership. We tend to generalize about presidents. President Carter, ineffective in dealing with Congress. Ronald Reagan, wonderful at sort of galvanizing public opinion. George Bush, unclear. We'll have to wait. But we tend to generalize about leadership styles when, in fact, they vary significantly from issue to issue. And I'm not just talking about foreign policy versus domestic policy. We've known that for a long time. But much more refined differences than that. And just a hunch, I would guess that if we went back and looked at the past five or six presidents and how they behaved across the same issue area, fairly narrowly defined, we'd see a lot of similarities there that we might not have expected. That's just a hunch. I can't back it up, but that's what I think. Third point, these committees vary significantly in their partisanship. Labor is very partisan, Environment and Public Works isn't. You see a lot of partisan voting in labor. At the same time, the party organizations, the infrastructure of the party in those two committees is very similar and is weak. A lot of people have observed voting behavior on the Senate and House floor in the 1980s and have noticed it's become more partisan than it used to be 10, 15 years ago. They argue from that there seems to be a resurgence in the congressional parties. I don't buy that at all. The reason you see this increase in partisan voting is the same reason you see a lot of it in the Labor Committee. It just happens that Republicans agree and Democrats agree. In other words, there's a degree of preference homogeneity within the parties. And that's what's driving this increase in partisanship on the floor, not some resurgence in the parties as structural entities, as organizations. The party leaders in Congress now don't have that much more in the way of prerogatives and formal powers than they did in the 70s. If we're expecting to see some sort of resurgence in party leadership, I just don't see it anytime soon. A couple of other points I want to make, three actually. Fourth, continuing along, administrative management sides to leadership are important, and there's something we need to talk about. One prominent student in the Senate has described senators as janitors for an untidy chamber, and they certainly are. I don't think they're very good at cleaning up, but they're janitors for an untidy chamber. The thing, though, I think you've seen in these two chairs is that the administrative side of leadership just isn't that important. They can make the trains run on time. Things work more efficiently, but that does not translate into power. Howard Baker, Republican majority leader in the early 80s, focused on the administrative managerial side of leadership, and he was a weak leader. And that, I think that's a fair generalization, that whenever you have a leader focusing on those sorts of things, he or she's not going to have much of an impact. Fifth, procedure can matter. It can matter a great deal. It mattered for both Hatch and Stafford. But where it really made a difference was with Hatch, and Hatch used it to block things. Procedure can be used to push things forward, but it's not as effective for that as it is for blocking things. Thus, if we're interested in a leadership which actually builds coalitions and works towards constructive change, procedural tactics are only going to take them so far. The crucial thing for coalition building, then, where leadership really has an opening, I believe, is when it comes down to imperfect information, uncertainty, where leaders have greater access to information. There is where we really can expect to see effective leadership, creative leadership. We need to think a lot more about the way legislators learn and the way information is transmitted to understand the openings for leadership. And we also need to be more, perhaps, sensitive to where leadership is likely to occur. You're not going to see it on abortion, school prayer, or busing. There, leaders aren't going to make that much of a difference because power runs from the bottom up. People have made up their minds, and information is pretty full. We have a pretty good idea what happens if an abortion rider passes. I mean, there's not much uncertainty there. Where you're going to see leadership and where we should look for it is on technical legislation, complex legislation, and legislation where preferences are fluid and people haven't quite made up their mind. And the more the issue agenda at the national level is dominated by those kinds of issues, the greater the probability that we'll see a leadership that will really make a difference. And I think environmental policy, as many people say, moves to the forefront of the public agenda, perhaps we'll see a more effective leadership in Washington. Well, that's all I have to say. Too much. Went over by about 10 minutes, but that's not bad for me. I'd like to take any questions you have.
Who would like to ask the first question? Bill Wemple?
Maybe you covered this. Who writes the bills and who decides who's going to write them?
Well, the actual language often is supplied by the Office of Legislative Counsel. The ideas but that's a technical aspect. The actual ideas, it varies. Quite often they come from interest groups. I know of instances where interest groups have walked into an office and said, here, introduce that. They've handed them the language and it's gone on the floor. There have been other cases where the language is entirely due to an executive agency. Sometimes bills are introduced by request. The executive branch will come down and say, look, we want you to introduce this for us. I'll do it that way. a lot of the times staff will play a very prominent role. I think it's safe to say that the legislators themselves never sit down and craft this language, never. What's really important, though, as far as the language, is not so much the bill language as the report language, because the bill language is very technical. The report language explains what's in the bill, and that's almost always provided by staff. So it varies from issue to issue, but some mixture of the above is usually the pattern.
Is that directed by the chairman?
Primarily, the product of the labor of a subcommittee chair. The subcommittee chair's staffers might handle the report language, but I should say this, the chair always supervises it and always has final say over what that looks like.
Next question, Professor Fernbach.
I wonder if you would get into the role of the media and use the media as a power factor for the chairman.
That's important. I don't deal much with that because committee chairs aren't as able to do that as the executive. That's certainly a central tool in presidential power. But I should say that since Kennedy has taken over the Labor Committee, he's done that quite effectively. You remember there was a plant closing bill a couple of years ago that was an issue in the campaign. He went public on that. The public was not really aware of that issue when the legislation came forward, but he had a very systematic media strategy that he used, targeting, you know, beaming up messages to satellites, amazing stuff out of a congressional committee. And I talked to his press secretary for a long time about this strategy and was just amazed. And Kennedy did use the media to his advantage to sort of mold public opinion and use that as a leverage, as leverage against the administration. That's rare, though. Very few people have Kennedy's ability to mobilize the press.
I was thinking also outside of these two committees of anti-crime work.
Sure.
Which the committee hearings on TV.
Sure.
Or the work done on uncovering the difficulties of HUD.
Sure, definitely. There you see it, definitely with HUD. Most of this is televised on C-SPAN, however, and I'm addicted to C-SPAN to the point that, you know, my son and I stay up late hours, particularly when he needs to be fed at 2 or 3 in the morning, watching C-SPAN, but I don't know how many people are like me. More people should be, but their preferences aren't as perverse as mine. So.
By then you've moved over to the British Parliament, though.
Well, yeah. And the Canadian House of Commons. Yes. Let's not leave them out. The Polish Diet, I mean, it's great.
Any questions?
Yeah,
Carol Jackson.
The numbers of committees and staffs
The number, the proliferation of staffers and committees? The number of committees has been fairly stable for the past few years. Number of subcommittees has gone up and down, but fairly stable. Staffers, number of staffers has gone way up. Well, it depends on how you look at it. To a certain extent, if staffers are generating work, in a sense, they're providing more uncertainty in the process, making it more difficult to get things done, simply because there's more to do and less time. On the other hand, staffers might be a source of information. So the extent, if you want to strengthen leadership, for example, if you can increase the number of staffers working for them, my guess is you've made the process work better. If on the other hand, and this is generally what happens, you disperse staff resources so more people have more access to staff, then you've undermined the role of leadership. So it depends on your view. I think we've got plenty of staffers in Washington. I've got a lot of students who would like to join their rank, but I think we've got enough. That's just my view, though.
Other questions?
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm not sure I understand who determines the number of staffers and also who determines the number of subcommittees in any major committee.
Okay. Well, the committees receive staff allowances from the chamber. So in a sense, the chamber sets a limit on how much you can spend on committee staff. Within that constraint, the chair and other members of the committee decide how they're going to divvy it up. As far as the number of subcommittees, that seems to me, I know in the House they're limited by chamber rules. I think they are in the Senate as well. but the composition of the subcommittees, and to a certain extent their number, is also set by the committees as a whole. So legislators basically control their own structure, their own institution. And it should come as no surprise then that it's set up in such a way to promote their goals, which is quite often re-election.
Victor Yonke.
On the House Committee on the bill, is that found by the lower level, or does the chairman still get into the picture on that?
I'm not sure I understand on that.
Joe, the compromise between a House bill and a Senate bill.
Sure, conference committee then. The leadership, the chair, the subcommittee chair, the top members of the committee, almost invariably.
Other questions? Colonel Foote?
Say a word as to how leadership in both the Senate and the House is functioning with regard to this big problem right now of developing this year's budget.
Not well. I only know what I read in the Washington Post, and they seem to be dropping these hints that a big agreement is somehow near, but I have no idea what it's going to look like. I would doubt very much that any significant attempts at balancing the budget have been. We're going to see that. Who knows what they're going to come up with. It'll probably be some mixture of budgetary tricks and gimmicks and a few compromises. But so much of that has been behind closed doors. I mean, they've been meeting, at Andrews Air Force Base or someplace and behind closed doors without staff trying to carve this thing up. Who knows what they're going to come up with. But apparently there's a decision.
Wilson Newman.
Right.
Oh, Professor, your talk emphasizes the enormous importance of the committees. Could you comment just a bit on how the committees got there and about the changes in committee membership and the extent to which the chief executive has any input into this?
Okay. Well, the last point, the president has no input into this whatsoever. If he ever tried, he'd be pushed off very quickly. Committees, though, have been there for 200 years. They weren't necessarily, they weren't part of the institution when it was first created, but they emerged quickly over time because it was obvious that the chamber as a whole needed some division of labor for efficiency grounds. And they emerged slowly through the first half of the 19th century. The modern committee system in the Senate, I think, probably took hold around 1920 or so. And we've seen some changes since then. It used to be the committee chairs were much more powerful than they are now, particularly in the 1950s when LBJ was the majority leader. Very different kind of Senate than we have now, much more traditional, a lot more deference to leadership. And since the 60s into the 70s, the power of chairs has gone down. And rank and file members are much less likely to defer to them. So they sort of follow the general trajectory of the institution. They reflect it in many ways.
We hear from time to time that people within the organization, after an election occurs, that there is electioneering for members on various committees.
Mm-hmm.
Is this resolved in party caucus?
It can be. Now, that's more on the House side than in the Senate. In the Senate, there are fewer members, of course, and as many committees as you have in the House. Thus, there's less competition for any one committee. They tend to get the committee assignments they want. On the House side, though, there's often tremendous competition for important assignments. And usually they're worked out in what they call the Committee on Committees, which is this little organization that decides who gets what. But if there's a fight, it can go to the caucus. So the caucus is sort of the last resort.
It's resolved on seniority, though.
Usually, but not always. Less so now than it used to be. Sure.
I don't disagree with the factors that you're saying go into
sure.
determining how a senator leads or how effective he is, but when I worked for the Senate, I guess what I noticed and what I hadn't thought of before was when they say it's a club, it is a club. You have 100 members, and I was struck by the way senators spoke with each other in elevators, in the halls, on the floor, in subcommittees, at press conferences. I'm just wondering if, whether or not you agree that individual rapport between senators is extremely important. When you have, for instance, Hatch and Kennedy walk up to each other on the floor and obviously have a very, very pleasant conversation, you can see the role that a person's personality and the rapport that they establish with other people plays. And I don't know how you would measure that, but.
It's hard. Certainly, psychological characteristics and personality matters to a certain extent. I think, though, that tends to get overemphasized. You got to remember that these are, it's not a club. It's not a club anymore. These are 100 individuals who basically lead small businesses, huge staffs. They don't know each other the way as well as they used to in the 50s. And I don't think personal relations are anywhere near as crucial as they were before. A lot of senators don't know their colleagues. And I think that primarily what they're responding to is contextual factors, political factors. Personality is important on the margin, but it's not crucial. I also think it is very difficult to generalize about personality in a systematic fashion. I don't really know how you go about doing that. I have my own impressions, but they're just my impressions. There's no way to be objective. So I guess I agree with the thrust of what you're saying, but it's more a question of emphasis.
Strong leadership would certainly seem to be in theory good and to increase the effectiveness of the legislative process. In view of that fact, what would you think of the current move to limit the terms of members of Congress and therefore decrease the importance of seniority and the experience that seniority conveys?
Yeah, I don't care for these reform proposals. I think some of them have been there way too long, and we'd be better off if they were gone. Other senior members I think are highly valuable, and I would just hate to see not in the chamber. Bottom line is, I think, you know, experience matters, that some of these issues are extremely difficult to deal with, and I like the fact that you've got a Sam Nunn there on Armed Services who's been doing that job for 20 years. I think Strom Thurmond lends something unique to that chamber, just unique, because he remembers the way the institution used to be, and he's got more perspective on how it operates. The younger members tend to be more interested. A lot of people say they're smarter. I don't know if that's the case or not. They tend to be more interested in currying favor with the press. I like the fact that we've got some senior members in there, and I guess I just don't want to see him go, certainly not with an arbitrary sort of limit like that. Bottom line is, it's never going to happen. So I don't worry about it too much. Although I agree with you, a lot of them shouldn't be there. They've been there too long.
Oh, no, really, I agree with you. I'm against limiting it, too. I was just wondering how you thought about it.
Yeah.
Does the popular decline and status of congressmen in any way affect their conduct of the business of the Senate or the House, do you think?
To a certain extent, it does. I mean, what you see more often than you used to, this is well documented, is legislators running for re-election by running against the chamber, and that sort of carries over into the institution. They tend to treat the institution in a derogatory fashion. And I don't find that particularly attractive. It's certainly counterproductive for the institution as a whole. So in that sense, and in a sense, it's also contributed to lowering dissatisfaction. That has had an impact. Other ways, too, people know that legislators know that they're not trusted. Therefore, it's harder for them to vote for things like pay raises. The ethics issue becomes very politicized. All these things. So it's a problem. I mean, I see it as a major problem. Reflects our times, I guess.
Did you say anything about committees going up and going down in importance? And the Senate Foreign Relations used to be something everybody sought to become a member of, and now less so.
That's true. I think committees generally are less important in the Senate than they used to be. I think foreign relations is much less important than it used to be. On the other hand, committee chairs and subcommittee chairs are nice forums. They bring with them staff and media, and that's power in the Senate. Edward Kennedy, one reason why he has such an impact these days is that he's chair of the Labor Committee. So I think you're right, on average, committees are less important now than they used to be, but they're still really important, crucial parts of the process.
Any other questions? Howard Crumlin.
Is it true that a few of the committees do have executive section? I'm thinking of Sam Nunn's committee.
Mm-hmm.
But this is not universal, it's more related to a particular committee like the Army.
Sure. By executive session, I think you mean they meet in private. Basically, yeah, the press isn't there. That's right. Armed Services meets in private quite often. It's because it's sensitive material. That's very rare. Most committees meet in public.
Yeah.
Now, there are certain committees that don't want spectators, so they meet in rooms about the size of this, and you can't get inside. But they're not officially closed to the public. And indeed, this is valuable for me in my research. Transcripts are kept of these markup sessions, verbatim transcripts, in the offices of the committee. So it's possible to go back 4 or 5 years and actually read what was said to get a feel for the panel. You can't do that on Armed Services, though, because those are closed to the public.
You think that's good or bad for reaching agreement?
Well, it's good for me. I don't know. I think it's probably bad. I think they probably achieved compromise a bit more easily when interest groups weren't watching. I don't know how you'd measure that, but that's my sense. Of course, I've never seen anybody in there reading these documents but people like me, so I don't know. Or graduate students. A lot of graduate students.
Well, I hope our sessions on governance in the future can be as meaty and full of information and insight and empirical data as our discussion today, and to have it presented with the verve and excitement that our speaker has given is a real plus. Some of you might like to know that he also is teaching the course on Congress in the Department of Government at the University of Virginia this year, so the university is doubly privileged in having him both for this kind of forum but also teaching students. So we're delighted that you could visit us. Hope you come back.
Pleased to come. I enjoyed it.